From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Andy Williams is my guest this week. He's just published a memoir entitled Moon River and Me. Andy Williams, of course, is one of the great singers in American popular music, and he's sold a jillion albums, and he's been a star in nightclubs and concert halls, and for many years was the host and star of a classic variety television program. Tonight, he returns to his roots in radio by appearing here with us. Andy Williams, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thanks very much. Nice to be here.
I'd like to talk to you a bit about your recording career. I mean, you've done so many things in show business, but recordings were always a major part of that. I mean, did you feel that making records was as important as live performing, or was television your main focus? Where did recording come?
Well, I think all of them came pretty close together, especially the television and recording. They just went hand in hand. I had so much exposure on television for so many years, and recording at the same time just seemed like the way to go. And at some times during my career recording, I'd record 3 albums a year. Which is really a lot,
yeah,
compared to what's happening today.
Right.
People sometimes take a year or more to record an album.
A lot of artists take 5 years or something for between records.
Yeah, but in those days when I was doing the television series and I was recording for Columbia, I did record 3 albums a year.
Now, your very first recording session was backing Bing Crosby as a vocal group on Swingin' on a Star, one of our favorite records.
That was about 1944, with my brothers, of course, and we had just met Bing Crosby, and we were young. I don't know, I was 16 or something like that. I guess I could figure out how old I was.
Do you remember?
I was about that age, or 15 or 16, something, and we made a background. We were the background really for Bing Crosby on Swingin' on a Star.
And do you remember that session? Do you remember Bing Crosby walking in and so forth?
Oh, yeah, I do. I remember that, and I remember we were all scared to death to meet him. And to sing with him was, you know, a big treat. We had just come from Cincinnati, Ohio, where we had a radio show there for a couple of years every morning. And my father was determined that we were going to get in the movies. And we thought he was nuts. But he was the boss, and we drove from Cincinnati to Los Angeles, and within a very short time, he had managed to make this connection with John Scott Trotter. We had done a lot of Hollywood canteen and servicemen programs that were sent overseas to the servicemen, and I guess that's how John Scott Trotter knew about us. And so we were called in to do the session with it.
Or would you like to swing on a star? Carry moonbeams home in a jar and be better off than you are.
Or would you rather be a pig?
A pig is an animal with dirt on his face. His shoes are a terrible disgrace. He has no manners when he eats his food. He's fat and lazy and extremely rude.
But if you don't care a feather or a fig, you may grow up to be a pig.
Or would you like to swing on a star? Carry moonbeams home in a jar and be better off than you are.
Or would you rather be a fish?
Would you say that Bing Crosby had been a big influence on your singing?
No, you know, we were a group, and I don't think we were influenced really by any single singer. We were only interested in group singers.
Uh-huh.
We, of course, knew Bing Crosby. He was a big movie star and a big recording star. And
right.
Heard him on the radio all the time, but he never influenced any of us because we weren't soloists.
At that point, did the Williams brothers go on to record any records under their own name, or were you just backing on MGM music?
We did make a record of Christmas songs years and years later, you know, during the television series of mine.
Mm.
We recorded an album of the Williams Brothers Christmas, which is really one of the best, Christmas album put out today.
Now, your first record label as a solo artist was Cadence, and we know them from the Everly Brothers and some other. How did you become involved with them?
Well, I wanted to make records. I just started on the Steve Allen Tonight Show. This was like in the 50s, in the mid-50s. And I wanted to record, and I chose Archie Blyer's Cadence Records because of the Everly Brothers, really. And they were having hits, all kinds of hits. And it was a small label, and they were doing very well, and they also had the Cordettes.
Right, Mr. Sandman.
Sandman and Lollipop, and a lot of other things. And so Kay Thompson, whom I had worked with my brothers for several years, with an act called Kay Thompson and the Williams Brothers, we played supper clubs around the country. A very popular act in supper clubs. The biggest, I think, supper club act around. And she knew Archie Blyer, and I said, I would love to be on Archie Blyer's record label. She said, well, I'll arrange an audition. So she called him and set up an audition, and she played for me, and I sang for him. And he said, "Well, let's record. Let's." Said, he's talking to Kay. He said, "His voice is different than anybody else's that I've heard. He doesn't sound like anybody else, and that's good. So we've got a chance. It's just a matter of finding the right songs." And then with Archie, it was just a matter of spending a lot of time with him and going over material. Between the two of us, in just hours and hours and days of looking for stuff and trying things, and finally, when he had found a song that he thought was had a chance of becoming a popular hit, we'd go in and record it. And many times he was right.
Now, I think fans of yours today would be surprised to hear Butterfly, because it really does sound like a rock and roll record.
Well, he gave that song to me, and he said, "Here, just try this." And he played me a record of Charlie Gracie doing the song. And Charlie Gracie had the same kind of a rockabilly kind of attitude about a song that Elvis Presley had. I figured that if I was going to do this thing, and I didn't want to do it because I didn't think it was, I said, "This is not my style." And Archie said, "What do you mean your style? You haven't got a style. We haven't had a hit record yet, so why don't you? What do you mean? This is your style." So he said, "Well, then I'll give it to someone else if you don't want to do it. But it is a hit record." So I finally went into a studio, and I had played an Elvis Presley record before making it, and trying to get this feeling of a rockabilly kind of song. And I knew I wasn't going to sound like Elvis Presley, and I didn't want to, but I thought that would help me to get the feeling of what that song had to have. So I went in the studio, and I started singing kind of like an Elvis Presley imitator. "You tell me you love me, you say you'll be true, and you fly around with somebody new, but I'm crazy about you, you butterfly.
You're treating me mean, you're making me cry. I've made up my mind to tell you goodbye, but I'm no good without you, you butterfly. I knew from the first time I kissed you that you were the troubling kind. Caught the honey drips from your sweet lips. When tasting, I'm out of my mind. I love you so much, I know what I'll do. I'm clipping your wings, you're flying us through. Cause I'm crazy about you, you butterfly."
It was really what the record needed to make it, you know, make it make sense. And it was a big hit. It was the biggest hit I ever had, biggest single record.
It's a great recording.
Well, I hated it so much after I did it. That what I later on, when I bought Cadence Records from Archie Blyer, and I sold my product, my record that I had recorded with Archie, I sold it to Columbia, because I didn't want my records going in supermarkets and drugstores, you know, to cut rate discount. And he was selling it to a group called what was the name of that?
K-Tel or one of those?
Pardon?
K-Tel or one of those?
Yeah, well, it was that kind of a record company.
Yeah.
And so I asked him how much he was offering the record company for when he was trying to sell it to Pickwick. Actually, it was Pickwick.
Pickwick, uh-huh, sure.
And he told me what it was. I said, well, I'll pay you that if I can have, if I can buy the company. He said, fine, buy it.
So
I bought it, and I sold my stuff then to Columbia Records with the provision that they could never release Butterfly. And so they bought it, and then I am left with all of these records of Everly Brothers and the Cordettes and Johnny Tillotson and all the people that had recorded for Cadence over the years. And there were a lot of people. Lenny Welch had a big record on Since I Fell For You. Johnny Tillotson had records like Poetry in Motion and some other songs. Were. So anyway, I had records, and so I formed a record company, which I called Barnaby Records after my dog. So then I put all of these songs in Barnaby Records. Now I've got a record company, and I started recording the Osmond Brothers because they didn't have a deal, and recorded several things with them, and didn't have the right as Archie Blyer. So often said to me, you got to find the right song. I never was able to find the right song for the Osmond Brothers. I didn't really know much about the record business, but I was trying to get them going because I thought they were so talented. And then after a while, somebody else came along with a record with a song that was perfect for them. And they recorded it, and became a big hit. It wasn't on my label, but it was on another label, and I was very happy they had a hit, because that's all I wanted them to have. They went on to have great success in records, enormous success over the years, but not on my label.
Unbelievably, listeners, if you're just joining us, Andy Williams is here, and we're happy to be speaking to him, and he's just published a wonderful memoir called Moon River and Me, which has some wonderful laugh-out-loud moments that you should all read.
Yeah, there are some funny things in it.
It's a great book. But let me ask you, so you moved to Columbia, and I know I think probably most of the songs that you have recorded were covers of songs that previously existed, but one of my favorite records of yours is Can't Get Used to Losing You, and I think that was your song. Did anybody ever record that before you?
No. That was one that Archie Blyer would have chosen. I'm sure, had he that come across his desk. But instead it came across Bob Mercy. Robert Mercy was my producer at Columbia when I first went there. And he said, this is a hit song. And I heard that before from Archie so much that I said, okay, I'll do it. But I didn't like it. I didn't think it was a hit song.
You didn't like the song?
No. Well, I didn't think there was enough there. You know, just kind of. Yeah. Kind of. It's a very simple song.
I think it's one of the great, not only is it a good song, but it's one of the great records of all time.
Well, I just thought, guess there's no use in hanging around. Guess I'll get dressed and do the town. I'll find somebody, wait and see, or something like that. I don't know. And then, can't get used to losing you no matter what. I try. I just thought it's a dumb song.
Guess there's no use in hanging around. Guess I'll get dressed and do the town. I'll find some crowded avenue, though it will be empty without you. Can't get used to losing you no matter what I try to do. Gonna live my whole life through loving you. Call up some girl I used to know. After I heard her say hello, couldn't think of anything to say. Since you're gone, it happens every day. Can't get used to losing you no matter what I try to do. Gonna live my whole life through loving you.
And it wasn't until I heard it later with what Bob Mercy did with the arrangement, with that pizzicato string going boom, pink, boom, pink, boom, pink. You know, that's what really made the record, I think.
I think it's a combination.
And then we doubled, you know, sang the harmony part on Can't Get Used to Losing on the chorus. But as a song, I thought it was just dumb. I think now that I look back at it, I think it's a really great record.
It's been a favorite of mine since I was a kid. Did you ever hear any of the interesting cover versions? I think one that was...
I heard one from a group in England.
Yeah, the Beat. You didn't like that?
No, I hated it.
Well, you said in your book, when you ever hear anybody else do Moon River, you say, wait a minute, that's my song.
Right. Well, I always felt that way about Moon River because, you know, once you get a song like that, like Tony Bennett has Left My Heart in San Francisco,
right,
you take a, you know, you take a priority feeling about it, like that's mine and nobody else should do it. Of course, everybody did it. I mean, Moon River has been recorded by hundreds of people.
Moon River, wider than a mile, I'm crossing you in style someday. Old dream maker, you heartbreaker, wherever you're going, I'm going your way. Two drifters off to see the world, there's such a lot of world to see. We're after the same rainbow's end, waiting round the bend, my huckleberry friend, Moon River, and me.
We're talking with Andy Williams. Let's just talk a little bit about television. You mentioned The Tonight Show. You came to be a regular singer on The Tonight Show back in the 1950s when Steve Allen was the host.
And I did a thing that I thought was very smart. I mean, when Archie said he wanted to record with me, then I said, I'd like to make an album of Steve Allen songs, because Steve was a pretty good writer. But I didn't know of anybody who had made an album of his stuff. But I knew I was going to be on his show, and if I was going to be on his show, and I had an album of his out, he'd probably want me to sing one of his songs every show, which he did. And so I got a lot of exposure singing his stuff.
And what was it like being on The Tonight Show? Were you part of the comedy, or did you just sing?
Well, I did. You know, Steve Lawrence was the other male singer, and Edie Gourmet was the female singer.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was one other girl that changed two or three times, but ended up with a girl named Pat Kirby, and she was on for about 2 years, I think. I was on for 2.5 years. And Steve Lawrence and I alternated. I was on two nights 1 week and three nights the next. And, you know, whenever Steve Allen had a comedy bit or something that he wanted to do, he would use whoever was around. And, you know, if it was a Russian bartender in the thing, he'd say, okay, Andy, you're a Russian bartender. And so I got a lot of experience that way. I was a terrible Russian bartender. I started with Chinese.
Well, you have a lot, you know, when you were doing your own television show, you were very at ease with comedy. Was that because you rehearsed a lot, or you didn't rehearse at all?
We did rehearse a lot, but that, you know, I think I'm from Kay Thompson, and my brother's doing this nightclub, supper club act that we had for, like, off and on. We had it for like 3 years, and we stopped for about a year, and then we went back again and did it another year and a half, I think. During that time, we did a lot of comedy, a lot of funny things, a lot of satire. With the stuff I had done with Steve Allen, I'd learning, you know, how to be a straight man. And I just had a very, it was easy for me to do that. You know, to be Dean Martin rather than Jerry Lewis.
Right. Of course, you weren't drunk like Dean. I mean, you never did it. You never had a shtick like that. You were just kind of an easy guy.
No, but I knew, and I had an instinct about comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And I used it a lot on shows.
Tell us a little bit about your nightclub act or your supper club act with your brothers and Kay Thompson. What was the act like? What would we have seen?
It was something that hadn't been done before. A lady and four dancer singers around her. That seems silly now, but at the time there was no act like that. I mean, acts just vocal group acts just stood around a microphone and sang. This was like a intimate review. Broadway review. There were sketches, songs, dancing, a lot of funny kind of material. Kay wrote it all. All very sophisticated, kind of Noel Coward kind of things. And it was very exciting, and nobody had ever done anything like that, of singing and dancing and moving around. And Kay had a friend at the MGM Studios, because she was the head of the vocal department at MGM for years, and did all the musical comedy things with Fred Astaire and Judy Garland and Gene Kelly, and did all of those big MGM musicals and wrote all of the choral stuff and worked with all of the soloists, you know, like June Allison, Judy Garland, and the movies that they would make. And she had a great friend there named Bob Alton, who's a choreographer. And the two of them put this act together. And it was so fast and so exciting and so mobile that finally when we got to seriously think about, you know, getting a job in a nightclub, and the first one we had was in Las Vegas at the El Rancho Vegas, we suddenly realized that this was a very difficult act to do because we couldn't have microphones in our hands. There was no such thing as a lavalier microphone then. And Kay Thompson had been rehearsing in slacks, and we would be lifting her up over our heads, and she put on her dress, and her dress came falling down over her face. You know, it was just a comedy of, you know, errors in a way that none of us really realized. And she had the orchestrations made for a big MGM size orchestra. And we went into these little places, and there would be like a six-piece band. It was just stupid. So we ended up using a lot of just rhythm sections and putting on big endings, you know, big endings with whatever instruments were there, playing unison chords. It was just silly. But anyway, she ended up having to wear slacks, but she invented a thing called Kay Thompson Fancy Pants. And they were made out of very soft material and would flow very nicely, but they were actually pants. And then we ended up hanging microphones over a beam in the first place we worked at. The four of us, my brothers and me, got up on a ladder and hung these things over a beam that was in the room and hung them down so that they were about, 6 feet above us. And this had never been done, and the entertainment director at that place came screaming, and he said, "You can't do that. You're rousing up the looks of my place." And we said, "Well, we've got to do it." And then after the first show that we did, and the people went so nuts, he came barreling back wanting to sign another deal right away. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning of nightclubs in Vegas hanging microphones for production numbers. It just started a lot of stuff. And then a lot of people like Lisa Kirk and I'm trying to think of this other girl, started acts where they would have four dancers or singers around them. But up until that time, nobody had ever done anything except stand around a microphone and sing, and at the end of a number, everybody would sort of raise their arms up, you know, at least the two end people. That was what group singing was then.
Well, speaking of all the innovations that Andy Williams has brought forth in show business, I was watching some of clips from your wonderful Andy Williams show, and one of the things I noticed is everyone is wearing a jacket and tie except for you.
I copied that, I guess, from Perry Como. He wore a sweater, and it was the kind of informal kind of show that I wanted to have.
Did the network ever say, put a tie on?
No. They sort of let me do what I wanted to do. I don't think they had any objection to it. And I did wear a shirt and tie and a jacket out of the show.
Mm-hmm.
All my closing numbers were that way. All my opening numbers were that way. There was only sections in the middle where there's, I would sit out on a kind of a ramp thing that went out into the audience and sit there and sing songs and talk to the audience a little bit, where I wore a sweater.
Your show, the Andy Williams Show, was very memorable. There's nothing like that on television today. It's kind of a lost art form, the variety show.
Unfortunately, that's true. It just has gone, went through a phase where it wouldn't get the ratings. We were getting good ratings. Dean Martin was getting good ratings. But his was more of a comedy show than mine. Diana Shore got good ratings when she was on. But then suddenly, musical variety shows couldn't compete with Law and Order and those kind of shows. And they just, because of the ratings, the networks wouldn't put them on. And they tried every once in a while. They try a show with Dolly Parton or something.
Right.
And they wouldn't make it in the rating.
I even thought, when I first heard that Jay Leno was going to do that 10 o'clock show, I thought, well, maybe he'll do a variety show, but he really didn't.
I think he wishes he had. Same kind of thing that he was doing at nighttime, and spending more time with guests, I guess, than usual. It was just a dumb, well, we all know it was dumb now.
Yeah.
But at the time, NBC, I guess, thought it was a good idea. It turned out it was the worst possible idea that could ever happen. I got in more trouble by moving Conan O'Brien into that spot. And then knowing that when Leno's show bombed so badly that they had to do something and then move him back to Tonight, but they already have got this up to stay with Conan. It was a really big mess, as everybody knows.
Do you think it was a worse mess than your show with Chico Marx?
No, that was only on for I don't know how many weeks it was on, maybe 26 weeks, maybe 13, I don't remember. But that was a terrible show. That was my first show.
Did you get to know Chico? Was he a nice fellow?
Oh, yeah, we all knew him. He was a nice guy. He owed everybody on the set money because he loved to gamble and was a terrible, terrible gambler and lost a lot of money.
Ask you, if you don't mind, about your first wife, the lovely Claudine Longet, and and she had a career in a recording career also and a film career. She was in that wonderful movie The Party, and she made some great records, which are now back in fashion. People are collecting her records and CDs, and in fact,
is that right?
Oh yeah,
I didn't know that.
And we all know that unpleasant things happened that ended her career. But she's the mother of your children. I wonder, are you still in contact with her, and how is she doing today?
She's doing great. She had a big trial, as you know, which I talk a great deal about in the book, because it was an important part of my life. The whole life of Claudine was, and the three children that we had together, very, very important to me, and I felt that she was wrongly accused. And the trial that ensued afterwards was just worldwide, way out of hand. Way, way out of hand. And she eventually married the lawyer that we found for her to represent her. And they're very happy, and a nice guy. And I talked to her. We exchanged gifts at Christmas time. I don't see her very often, mainly because my current wife now feels that if she came to Branson, and Branson being a small place, it would be disruptive.
Mm.
And I think she's probably right.
Yeah.
And I remember at one time at the flooding when we were separated and she was going with Spider Savage, that she had said to me, because I used to have to ask her quite a bit, she said, maybe you shouldn't come up so much because everybody talks about us when you're here. This is really where I live now. This is my place. And I'd appreciate it if you didn't come up there. I said, fine, I understand that. And so then Debbie, later on, I understood what she meant when she said, I don't think it's a good idea for Claudine to come here. And it's a too small a place. And so I knew she was right, you know. I could understand it anyway. Same way that Claudine felt about my coming up to Aspen. So I explained that to her, and she understood. So she's never been down to see my theater and my restaurant, which I wanted to show it to her because I knew she'd love it. No, we're very close friends, very good friends. Still lives in Aspen, and she spent a lot of time in Hawaii.
Oh, there's the famous dog.
I have dogs, and my wife has just arrived. She was out playing golf today, so they are very excited about seeing her.
You mentioned something in your book that piqued my interest. You were talking about your love of modern art, and you said that art was something that was completely outside your realm. But at the same time, I wonder, do you consider yourself an artist as a singer, or not?
Yes, I do. I do consider myself an artist. I don't know whether I said it was outside of my realm. I don't remember saying that, because as a kid, I used to draw a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved art from the time I was, you know, in school, high school. It wasn't until I got into New York and was living in New York doing the Tonight Show with Steve Allen that I was able to learn a little bit more about art by going up and down 57th Street. And actually, it was Kay Thompson and her influence on all of us that started my interest in art. And a friend of hers that visited her in New York, and we all sat around and talked a lot with him, was Stanley Marcus of the Neiman Marcus family. And he said, if you kids are interested in art, and I was, my brothers weren't that much, but go up and down 57th Street every day and look in these stores and all these galleries and go in and inquire about it and ask who that is and get to know the difference between a Picasso and a Braque. And eventually you'll get to where you have an opinion of your own about what you like and what you don't like. So I became very interested in doing that, and I did it a lot. And I would go into these stores, and I got to know them. And they said, here he comes again. What else do you want to know? And I just, I started collecting prints of French Impressionists. I hung them in my little apartment in New York City. Went to junk shops and bought frames and put the cheap, prints, which you could buy for $5 or $2 or something. I put them in these frames and put a picture light on them, and that was the lighting I had in my tiny apartment. So I had all of those kind of pictures around. And then when I got to where I was making a little bit of money, then I started buying lithographs of these same artists that I liked, Picasso and Braque and all the different artists of the day. Then when I started the television series and was in Los Angeles, I lived next door to a gallery, the Nicholas Wilder Gallery, and I would go in there all the time. And, every day I was in there, and I would look at all the stuff, and I started buying things from him. Every time he had a big show, I would buy something. And it might be $1,800, but it was a large painting. And some of them have become very valuable, some of these ones that I bought in the 60s. Then I started spending more money on art and then started really collecting in serious way.
Are you still a collector now, or you just have a collection?
No, I have a collection, and I have no wall space left, and I don't want to put them on the ceiling.
No.
But I I've also got to the age now where I'm thinking now about how I'm going to get rid of this stuff when I die. Well, I made a deal with Christie's that they, after I die, they will sell them all what I have, and the money will be divided among my children.
Well, I'm sure that'll be a long time away.
I hope so, but I don't know. I'm 82 now, and
82 is the new 60.
That's what they say. Yeah. I feel pretty good, and I don't have too many physical problems, except for last night when I drank too much wine. I feel pretty good.
Well, in your memoir, Moon River and Me, you talk about some other artists, Judy Garland and Elvis Presley and Frank Sinatra. And they all had their problems and obsessions. How did you, in your years in show business, avoid drugs and drink and women, or did you just choose not to tell us about it in your memoir?
Well, I didn't talk about it too much, but I did talk, you know, I did drink some. And I still do a little bit, but I try and keep it within reason. But I never really got into any drugs, you know, serious drugs.
And how did you avoid that? I mean, weren't they all over the place, or you just...
Yeah, it was, you know, and I sampled, but never really wanted it, you know. You know, you can't do a television show every week and work hard on it and be stoned. At least I couldn't. So I just, you know, you make a decision. What do you want to do with your life? And I decided that I would rather be straight and work.
A certain sound always follows me around. When you're close to me, you will hear it. It's the sound that lovers hear when they discover there could be no
The book, listeners, is called Moon River and Me, and the me is the great Andy Williams. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Well, I've enjoyed it. I really have. You've been a very good interviewer.
That's all the time we have for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back next week for another fine show. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at kusp.org or find us on Facebook and iTunes. I want to thank the great Andy Williams for being my guest this week. Pick up his memoir. It's called Moon River and Me, and it's a fine book. I want to thank also our From the Bookshelf staff, the sparkling Miss Breanne Beale, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. And thanks for listening, everybody. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro.